Degrees in Kenosha and Racine. The wind chill is 5 below. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We are spending today's morning show talking about two exciting events that are coming up this weekend at our neighbor to the north, the University of Wisconsin Parkside. In part two of today's program, we're going to be hearing from Brian Gill from the theater arts faculty about the next play being done by the theater department, and it happens to be a play by none other than Steve Martin, a play called Meteor Shower. And so we'll be talking about that a little later in the hour. We are beginning the program, however, with Dr. James Kinchin, who is director of choral activities at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. And of course, Dr. Kinchin has joined us any number of times to talk about various choral events at Parkside, and in many cases, those events have included performances of really extraordinary and also maybe rarely encountered works, and that seems to be something of a calling card for Dr. Kinchin. And this weekend's concert, actually concerts, one on Saturday night, one on Sunday afternoon, will be one such special event in which a really treasurable work that is very seldom performed is going to be part of the proceedings, namely a piece called The Ballad of the Brown King by a wonderful composer named Margaret Bonds. And so I'm so excited to have this opportunity to talk about this and other things that will be part of this weekend's concert by the choirs of the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Dr. James Kinchin, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Good morning, Greg. It is great to be back.
So let's just spend a moment talking about what I just made reference to, the fact that one of the things you have taken real pleasure in over the years is sometimes veering off the path of most often encountered old favorites to have your students and your audiences encounter and experience works that are a little bit off the beaten path, and in so many cases works that deserve a whole lot more recognition than they tend to receive. So is that a fair summation of part of what you like to do?
I think it is. I mean, and I would say that while we come a little bit short of doing that with evangelical zeal, we realize that composers have voices to the extent that their works are performed. Mm. And this is an opportunity to give voice to composers who are not often heard sometimes, works that people don't often know, alongside some of the tried and true treasures. So you remember we did the Abyssinian Mass of Wynton Marsalis back mm-hmm. in the spring, which was amazing. Choir at big band, you know, and a wonderful synthesis of styles. And so this performance has us doing Margaret Bond's cantata, The Ballad of the Brown King. Bonds, for listeners who may not know, was an African-American composer. Her dates are 1913 to 1972. She was born in Chicago, had the enviable opportunity to study music at an early age with Florence Price. And also William Dawson was one of her early teachers. At some point, she transitioned to New York and became a part of that wonderful efflorescence of arts and letters called the Harlem Renaissance, became fast friends with Langston Hughes. And at one point, and I don't know what the impetus for it specifically was, but asked Langston Hughes to provide words for her for this cantata. And so this cantata is a setting of words by Langston Hughes. So we have an opportunity to present that to people. Most people have not heard it or even heard of it. I've known it for some years. In fact, I did a piano choir performance of it in Milwaukee back in the early 90s. But it's a really delightful work, and it's accessible both to the performers and to the audience. And we get a chance to do it in this performance with orchestra and also with the collaborators. We'll talk about that later, from South Milwaukee High School.
Fantastic. I have known this work for some time because a former student of mine gave me the very same compact disc that you brought with you today. And I don't remember the circumstances under which that happened, but I am so glad that he gave this to me. And I actually wrote a laudatory, glowing review of this CD for the Journal of Singing. Because I just found so much on this to be really, really commendable. And it was, of course, so great to get to know a little bit more about this intriguing composer, Margaret Bonds. Before we talk more specifically about this work and hear a little bit from it, what else can you tell our listeners about her career as a composer? First of all, I am assuming that she probably unfortunately faced a lot of barriers and closed doors because of who she was and the community she came from.
Yeah, and that's an absolute fair and an astute assumption. She received her undergraduate education at Northwestern, and it was sort of for her a tale of two cities. On the one hand, she learned a lot, and in fact, you know, became just a fabulous pianist. As a result, of course, Florence Price and then going to Northwestern. But she also encountered barriers there, both those that were visible and those that were not visible to the naked eye until you try to do certain things.
Sure.
And so she became very, very aware of racism. And in fact, it is at that point, years before she ever met Langston Hughes, that she became acquainted with his poetry and she found some solace in it. Yes, and you know, consider that she has two strikes. She's a woman, and she's African American, and so it was an uphill climb for her in lots of ways, lots of barriers, and what is both happy and sad is that the happy news is that we get to do her work and have her speak to audiences that never knew that she existed. And the sad part is that probably she would have been happy if in her lifetime she had had this much acceptance.
Right. I mean, it's way after the fact. Better late than never, I suppose. But yeah, it's really sad to think about somebody crafting such wonderful music and then having it receive very limited attention far less than it really, really warrants.
And let me add to that part of what makes this particular work special is the way that it addresses those issues, even though in a kind of oblique way. So the Magi in tradition has them being three, and one of them being Balthazar, who is the dark king, perhaps Arabian, perhaps Ethiopian, who knows. But to make the statement that on this momentous occasion, the birth of Jesus, one of us, somebody of dark complexion, somebody of dark hue, was there. And for a people who were very much, more so than is still the case, very much marginalized in lots of ways and excluded even in some ways, right, to be able to be brought to the center of an important space, whatever that important space is, and to say, I am a part of this. You know, I'm not somebody on the fringes.
Right.
I'm a part of this. That was huge for her.
Of course. I can see, and it's not, there were 15 shepherds there, and one or two of them were black. It's there were three kings.
Yes, only three.
And one of them was black. I mean, to have that sort of dramatic, vivid representation in this scene, I can see how that would have a powerful effect. So we're going to be listening to actually several excerpts from this cantata. And again, for those of you just joining us, we're talking with Dr. James Kinchin about the two performances that are happening this weekend at Parkside, Saturday night and Sunday afternoon, of The Ballad of the Brown King by composer Margaret Bonds, an important black woman composer of the 20th century. So tell us a little bit more about her encounter with and ultimately, her collaboration with the great Langston Hughes.
Yeah, well, you know, as I said, she moved to New York, and there is where she met Langston Hughes. And of course, you know, the Harlem Renaissance or Black Renaissance, whatever term you want to use, was going on. And for listeners who have some sense of history, 20th century American history especially, this was coincidental with the Great Migration. You know, so from about 1910 or so, when it starts in earnest, the movement of black people from the rural South to the urban North, Midwest, and in some cases the West. And it goes on through the 1950s, okay? And, it changes the whole demographic landscape of a country. So there were people in Harlem, and there was a critical mass of people of all kinds who were interested in doing things. Some of them artistic, you know. There were painters, there were sculptors. You know, the musicians ran the gamut from people like Bonds, who was a quote unquote classical artist, small c, to people like some of the jazz greats like Duke Ellington and Cal Basie, and some of those folk who found you know, residence in that community. There were great poets. There were people, whom Langston Hughes is an example. You know, thinkers, and so here was a space where people could be themselves in all of the ways that they might define being themselves. They could be as learned as they wanted to be, as talented as they were born to be, and yet at the same time could be authentically who they were culturally and racially. And so that really gave fuel and gave impetus to her work. She and Hughes became, in her words, fast friends. And you know, one of the notes that we have from her said, an interview that she did, that they were like brother and sister. They, you know, they were really just in sync with each other. So that's one of the things that became, if you will, the ambiance out of which she created this work and a slew of other works. And I am still learning some of those other works and planning to share those with audiences and performers as time goes forward.
That's exciting. Yeah. So, remind me, I don't remember, did this work poetically already exist, or is this something that Langston Hughes crafted especially for Margaret Bonds for the purpose of
especially
it being
especially for Margaret Bonds. You know, I mean, you know, you think about that. You know, being being friends with a great poetic bard as Hughes was to say, Langston, I'm thinking about writing this cantata, and I want it to be about what do you can and he did the words for her. Yes, that was special.
Wow. So in a nutshell, I mean, although obviously we have a sense that this is about the nativity, but otherwise, what has Langston Hughes done with that familiar story?
Well, so he situates the Dark King as one of those who came to pay homage. And he begins with the words in the first movement of the three wise kings. There were one of them that came to pay homage. One of them was dark like me, and then he goes on to talk about them bringing fine gifts, and then there is the sort of rejoicing of the community, which is something that links to some of the folk music. What we might call spirituals that deal with nativity, going all the way back into the time of enslavement. It was not like once upon a time, long ago in a land far away, this thing happened.
Right.
It was like, it's happened. Mary had a little baby. Oh, she had a little baby. Oh, really? You know, it was that kind. Had that kind of currency, and so he captures that. And then as he moves through the cantata. There is the opportunity for the wise men on the, you know, the imagined stage, if you will, to make their first appearance. There came wise men from the East, and they were fairly demanding, where is he, where is he? You know, and this is sung by tenor and bass voices, okay? And then the tone softens a little bit. And I tell my people, because I'm trying to also get them not just to sing well in all of those things that are musical, but also to have this sort of affective connection with what the composer, and in this case the librettist, were trying to say. So we've seen a star in the East, and we've seen a star. We've come to worship him. And then the question, it's sort of the centerpiece of the, even though it's two-thirds of the way into the cantata, could he have been an Ethiop? The soloist leads us in by speculating. I don't know just who he was, but he was a dark king. And then there's this moment where the treble voices sing, oh, sing of a king who was tall and dark. And I think if you simply do the notes on that and you fail to connect with the kind of awe that these singers, you know, soprano and alto singers, had with just contemplating this tall, dark, good-looking guy, you know.
Yeah, that gives it a real extra layer of humanity.
It does,
that's
doesn't
a,
it?
Really,
it does,
really special.
Yeah.
You've brought this recording along of the Ballad of the Brown King, and the first excerpt you want us to sample, well, tell us about it.
Well, it's actually the second. I mean, it was hard to choose, but it's the second. And the second one, they brought fine gifts, to me has a really strong sensibility of the jazz big band. And you have to remember that here in Harlem, on any weekend, any night, really, you can go out and hear jazz. And on some of those occasions, you know, where you had the people like Duke Ellington, Count Basie, and Fletcher Henderson, and all of those people with their bands, that the folk really get dressed up in all of their finery. And so you have this sense of that being a permeating sensibility as you hear this. But they brought fine gifts of silver and gold, and you hear the extended harmonies. So if you, you know, for listeners, you know, if you think about a triad, la la la, you know, you have instead of 1 3 5 by itself, 1 3 5 7, 1 3 5 7 9, and that, so that kind of thing, and you hear that being played, and it is so rich and so sensuous to hear.
Let's hear some of this, an excerpt from Margaret Bonds' The Ballad of the Brown King.
Thank you.
That is sumptuous music, and harmonically, the language, as you say, is so incredibly rich. That's so beautiful. You have a second excerpt, which is you said, I think you called it kind of the moment of swooning, or to that effect.
It's a whole different sensibility that Margaret creates here. She gets exotic. You know, trying to add, and I always put this in quotes because there are different ways we could interpret it, trying to add an Eastern flavor to the music. And it ends up being very exotic, and it introduces this king after this rather extended introduction. And the treble voice is, "Oh, sing of the king who was tall and brown." And you can almost hear them exuding this sense of admiration for for this good-looking dark king.
Here's another excerpt then from The Ballad of the Brown King of Margaret Bonds. Wonderful, wonderful music from The Ballad of the Brown King of Margaret Bonds. We want to make sure to take a moment to talk about exactly who's going to be singing on these concerts Saturday night and Sunday afternoon at Parkside. It's not just your own singers.
Yes. Yeah, well, joining us being the University Chorale, the master singers, Voices of Parkside, will be the concert choir from South Milwaukee High School, under the direction of Amy Swanson, and also members of the Chamber Orchestra of South Milwaukee, directed by David Shaw. And so we're always eager to have those kinds of collaborations that bring young musicians to campus to do something with us that perhaps they might not be able to do or inclined to do by themselves, and all of the benefits, you know, intended and collateral that flow from that. And so we're real happy about that. Also, there are some solos in this work, and they're not huge arias, but they're delightful moments where we want to have them covered by people who really will represent well what Bonds wanted. And so we're pleased to have singing at soprano Julianne, once Fry, now she's Perkins, an alum of ours on the soprano, and another alum, Emmanuel Camacho, who will be doing some tenor work. And we also are just so pleased to be joined by our own, and I call him our own even though he's not an alum, he's part of our staff now, Edson Melendez, who's a fabulous tenor.
Yeah.
And so we're happy that we're going to be able to have those soloists.
Fantastic. How difficult is this work? I mean, how difficult has it been to master and prepare for performance?
Well, as you, that's a great question. As you know, every work that's worth doing has some level of challenge. And sometimes the challenge is in just getting the rhythms and pitches down. And at other times, it's in other places. The notes on this are not like all that difficult. Perhaps movement number two, which we just heard a portion of, may be the most challenging for singers to kind of get in their ears initially. But it's not a tremendously difficult work to learn. I think the challenge is in making the music. Mm. And we're still, you know, we'll be going on stage trying to make as much music with this as we can.
Sure.
Yes.
And of course, this performance, both performances will take place in beautiful Francis Bedford Concert Hall, one of the most beautiful performing spaces in all of southeastern Wisconsin.
Yes.
And I can just imagine this being just exquisite in that particular setting.
Yes, yes. And I think that's another plus for people who are going to come, and I hope everybody who's listening will come, and that you get a chance to be in what is both acoustically and aesthetically just a really splendid performing space.
Right. And of course, this is an exceedingly rare opportunity to hear this gem. I mean, one hopes it will become less rare an opportunity as time goes on. One hopes that little by little the world will come to appreciate and cherish this really gorgeous work by Margaret Bonds. And we don't have time to really talk about it, but I assume there are other things on the concert program.
Yes, there are other things as well. The Voices of Parkside will do its own little set of pieces, as well as University Chorale. And of course, those end up being sort of a combination of seasonal fare, as well as kind of giving an account of some of the other things we've done during the semester.
Excellent.
I'm happy to share.
Great. So Saturday night at 7 and Sunday afternoon at 3 in Francis Bedford Concert Hall.
Yes.
This concert that will include, of course, as its centerpiece, Margaret Bonds' The Ballad of the Brown King. We're going to hear a little bit of the final movement, the Hallelujah, that finishes out this wonderful piece. And on the podium for this weekend's concert, Dr. James Kinchin. Dr. Kinchin, great to reconnect with you, and great to hear a bit more about this wonderful piece by Margaret Bonds that will be performed this weekend. So best wishes to you and all of your musicians performing.
Thank you so much, Greg. It is always a pleasure to be here and talk with you. Thank you so much.
And here is a bit more of the finale to The Ballad of the Brown King by Margaret Bonds. Thank you. the final measures of Margaret Bonds's The Ballad of the Brown King. This was a recording by the Dessauff Choirs and Orchestra, led by Malcolm Merriweather. The time is 8:40. You're listening to the Wednesday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Greg Reberg. And in part two of today's morning show, I am delighted to welcome back into our studios Brian Gill, who is Assistant Professor of Theater Arts at the University of Wisconsin-Parkside. He teaches courses related to performance and Shakespeare and stage combat, and he is busy as well directing the next theatrical production at Parkside, namely the show Meteor Showers by the one and only Steve Martin. And I'm really excited to be able to speak with Brian Gill about this play and this production and what it offers. It opens, by the way, this coming weekend, December 1st. It runs through December 10th. So you have 2 weekends of opportunities to take in this production. And Brian Gill, we welcome you back to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg. It's good to see you.
Glad we can have this conversation. Did you have a good summer?
I had a lovely summer. Yeah, we're always very busy, but I'm definitely missing it on today with the snow and the 20 degrees.
Yes, we're recording this on a brisk Monday morning, but there you go. So the production that we are talking about over the next few minutes is a play that I must confess I had never heard of, Meteor Showers, and when I went looking for information, then I was even more surprised to see the name Steve Martin pop up, and it's just kind of incredible that something attached to someone so well known would nevertheless be a relatively obscure play. But that makes me all the more interested to find out more about it. So first of all, tell us about the selection of Meteor Showers to be part of this season at Parkside. Was that a decision you made, or are those kind of decisions more collectively arrived at?
The season selection is collectively made between my colleagues and myself. But with the success of Only Murders in the Building, which is a phenomenal series, which Steve Martin co-writes, I started thinking, well, maybe we should look at one of his plays. And so I just started looking through the plays that he has written, and I came across Meteor Shower, which I was not familiar with. And I floated the idea to my colleagues, and they liked the sound of it. And so, like you, having not heard of the play, I looked into it a little bit. And obviously got a hold of the script and read it, and was laughing out loud as I was reading it, which is always a good sign. And it had a short Broadway run, and it's just really funny and very smart. I'm a huge Steve Martin fan. I have been since I was a kid. And I've always gotten his humor, which I don't know if it's a blessing or a curse, but, so the opportunity to work on a play of his that isn't as well known as Picasso or The Underpants or his other works was really appealing to me. So it was a pretty easy decision for us to make to add it into our season.
I'm just curious if you can give us a little. You've already, in a sense, started to do that by naming a couple of other works by him. How extensive is his legacy as a playwright? I'm only also acquainted with his musical Bright Star, which Kenosha Unified did, I think, the year before last, and I was extremely impressed. And that was actually not a particularly funny show. It's actually a really, really serious story, but beautifully rendered, and it kind of piqued my curiosity, but I've never taken the time to explore further what he has written for the stage. Can you at least kind of summarize
his
legacy?
Sure. Yeah, his big hit is Picasso. I'm going to butcher the title because I don't speak French. His big hit is Picasso at the La Pangille, which is he's a fascinating playwright because, I mean, obviously he's incredibly intelligent and he's very funny, but he also has a real talent for the absurd and the surrealistic. So Picasso is all about a conversation in this bar cafe in Paris between Einstein and Picasso, and Elvis makes an appearance.
Oh,
and it's all these conversations, and that's really the one that I would say he is best known for. It's never been on Broadway, but it's regularly produced. I know College of Lake County just did a production of it that closed a few weeks ago. And that was one of the first that popped into my mind. He also wrote a play called The Underpants, which is a well-known play of his. And then the musical that you mentioned. And this meteor shower was pretty well received on Broadway. It played at the Long Wharf first and at the Old Globe in San Diego, was a big hit out there, and it's just a fun kind of a slapstick comedy that flirts with surrealism and a hint of time travel, and it's just kind of a comedic bullet train. It'll come in at about 80 minutes, no intermission, and it's just delightful.
I love plays like that. My favorite play is Doubt. I mean, it's very, very different from Meteor Shower, but
right.
Kind of a similar dimension. I mean, maybe even a little shorter than 90 minutes and no intermission. And
yep.
Like you just like you strap in and get taken for a ride and nothing interrupts it.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
I really love that. I wish more plays were constructed like that. So I know very little about this play, although it's the title in fact refers to one of the central events. There is some kind of meteor shower that
right.
is apparently drawing people together. Tell us more about kind of the heart and soul of the story.
Well, there is this meteor shower that is imminent, and this couple has invited Norm and Corky have invited this other couple, Gerald and Laura, and it's inferred that Norm and Gerald work together. And this meteor shower was mentioned, and Norm's has said that, you know, we live out in Ojai, California, and have a great view of the sky and you know, not a lot of light pollution. And Gerald kind of they don't invite themselves, but so wouldn't it be great if, you know, we could come over and see? So they invite this couple. Norm and Corky are a bit uptight and you know, everything in its place kind of a couple. And unbeknownst to them, I'm trying to do this without giving away too much. Unbeknownst to Norm and Corky, Gerald and Laura get they receive great enjoyment out of getting themselves invited to other people's homes and then waging absolute warfare on the couple whom has invited them. So they try to break couples up who invite them into their homes. and during the course of the play, Norm and Corky figure out what's going on and turn the tables on them. And it's just madcapery, and it's really funny.
Wow. When I just read a bare-bones summary, I mean really bare-bones, far briefer than what you just said, and it was about, you know, a couple and they invite another couple over, the first thing I thought of was, Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I thought, but I have a feeling I'm pretty sure this is a comedy. So
yes.
But boy, it sounds like there's just a little echo.
There is a little bit of that. Yeah, it is a comedic and surrealistic Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf.
Yeah, wow. So is the cast comprised entirely of these four people that are the
yes,
two couples?
Yes, it's a small cast, so it's a four-actor cast. All four of them are UW-Parkside theater majors. One is a minor. And it's just been great. I mean, the shorter length of the play really allows us to kind of dig in some ways. And the four of them, you know, hit it off immediately. Obviously, they know each other anyway because they're all involved in the theater department. But I was commenting to one of my colleagues the other day that during tech rehearsal, which can be pretty laborious, and this is a tech heavy show, I don't remember the last tech rehearsal that I was in where everyone was laughing so much, and we were just having a really good time, and that's, you know, that's always a good sign, especially when it's a tech heavy show and there's a lot to get through.
Yeah,
everyone was just was laughing a lot, and spirits were very high. So.
One wishes it could always be so, but
yes.
Of course it very seldom is, so that's great. Now I'm really surprised and intrigued to hear you say that this is a tech heavy show, because it sounds like it's mostly four people in a room.
Right.
So what is the tech all about?
Well, a big part of our production, we have some amazing projection abilities. And so we have full array of a meteor shower occurring behind the actors.
Wow.
We have the play will start with a sunset in pretty much real time. So as the audience is coming in and getting settled,
they will
watch the sunset.
Hmm.
And then all sorts of bells and whistles. I don't want to spoil too many of the surprises, but the entire upstage area of the set is projectionable. So it's,
wow,
it's a gigantic, essentially movie screen.
Cool. So is the meteor shower just an excuse for these four characters to be together, or is the meteor shower otherwise kind of a player in all of this?
The meteor shower does get a bit involved in the chicanery that is occurring between these four people. But yeah, it's the match that sets the rest of the play off.
Right.
This idea of this couple coming to have kind of a meteor shower party. And that's their way of getting in.
Right. So do we ever learn why this one couple gets their jollies from trying to break up other couples?
We have no idea. It just seems to be what they are interested in.
Wow.
Yeah, and they have just successfully destroyed a previous couple, so they're riding the high on that and have set their sights on Norman Corky.
Wow. And the tables will be turned on
them. Tables
from this
will be turned.
Wow.
Indeed.
So tell us more about Steve Martin's style of writing, and also if that style of writing presents any particular challenges to your young actors.
Steve Martin is, I want to say, deceptively smart, and I think that that's not remotely giving him enough credit. The man's brilliant. I say deceptive because in this play, a lot of it comes across as very kind of off the cuff humor, but as we were working on the play, it's each joke kind of has a couple layers to it, and some, you know, so what seems like a one liner, actually it's a one liner, but then he peppers it with a couple of little zingers afterwards that if you're not really paying attention, you'll miss.
Wow.
Or you'll suddenly hear and they make you laugh all over again.
Right,
so it comes across as kind of a slapstick light farce. But then as you start kind of unwrapping it, it's much more there's more depth to it, which I think one of the things that I've always appreciated about Steve Martin is he plays the fool really, really well. And then, as with all great fools, you realize he's the smartest guy in the room. And even as a kid, when I was watching him, when my parents would watch him, and my mom would just, you know, I just don't understand this man. He's just not funny. And even as a kid, I was saying, oh, I get this guy. You know, he is playing the square, but he's actually total counterculture, making fun of the squares, making fun of the counterculture.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, I think what sums him up for me is he has this old joke, the plumber's joke, or a joke for the plumbers. And if everyone listen, everyone within the sound of my voice should look this joke up. And it comes across as kind of like, this is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. But as it progresses, it's one of the funniest things you will ever heard. It's this joke that is geared specifically to any plumbers that might be in the audience. And it's hysterical. So that's the level of comedy that I really appreciate. You know, something that seems very effortless. And then you really start paying attention and you think, my God, this is really smart.
Yeah. What importance was there in... What do you think about in terms of casting these four actors who have to be two couples and very believable?
Mm-hmm.
What kind of chemistry do you look for? Or do you just trust that as actors they will be able to generate that through the rehearsal process and ultimately the performances.
Yeah, I mean, you're always looking for the elusive chemistry. In some ways, it's a lot easier now, certainly than it was when I was a young actor, both in academia and in the professional world, because now we have things like intimacy design and intimacy choreography designers. So that helps a lot. You know, back in the old days, it would be, okay, you two go in the other rehearsal room and figure something out and then come and show us.
Right.
What could possibly go wrong? but that helps a great deal. And for this one, I was looking for people who were pretty instantly comfortable with each other. Comedy is really, really hard. And the biggest challenge of comedy is that the people who are involved in the comedy don't know it's a comedy.
Right.
So the moment actors play the joke is the moment that the whole thing crashes and burns.
Right.
And I've been on the actors a lot about that. No, don't tell me this is funny. Show me that the stakes are immense and that this could blow up in your face. And then I will find it funny.
Right.
I was looking for people who had that openness, people who had a good sense of comic timing. Because I can teach a lot and I can coach a lot, but at the end of the day, those people that really have that inborn, innate sense of comic timing are worth their weight in gold.
Right. Well, and what you're saying about playing comedy in a sense straight, I mean, that's been said about a lot of people, including the great Lucille Ball.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's one of the things she would talk about, and they would even talk about how in real life she was not really a funny person at all,
right.
But she was a really good actress,
right? Absolutely.
And really knew how to fully embody her characters and be fully invested in whatever was going on. And I suppose part of the deal with comedies too is you want it to look effortless.
Exactly.
And of course, as you've already alluded to, it's far from an effortless undertaking.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Especially if you're looking at comic bits, or you're working on, well, what's the button to this? And this physical gag, how are we going to pull this off? Because for all of these characters, for Corky and Norm, their marriage is under assault. So that's not funny.
Right.
But for the audience, it's really very funny what is going on around them. But for Norm especially, this is not a fun night.
Yeah.
But it is through his struggle and the stakes being so high for him that hopefully the audience will be laughing and having a wonderful night of theater.
Yeah, sounds like that's exactly what this offers up. So we are recording this actually Monday morning, the morning of your first dress rehearsal.
First dress, yes, indeed.
And all the technical matters will be nicely aligned, I'm sure, by the time you open then on, so that's Friday the 1st.
Yes, Friday the 1st.
And you're running
at 7
for,
p.m.
And talk us through the array of performances then.
Absolutely. So we have the Friday, December 1st at 7 p.m. Then we have a December 2nd at 7 p.m., which is the Saturday. There's also a 2 p.m. on December 3rd, which is the Sunday matinee. And then we have that following weekend as well at the same times.
Very good. And people can go, of course, to the website of Parkside, uwp.edu, and it's
yes.
an easy website to navigate
yes,
to find
through,
your way to tickets and so on.
Through the Rita.
Yes, exactly. Brian Gill, director of the production of Meteor Shower by Steve Martin, opening this Friday night, running for the next two weekends at the University of Wisconsin Parkside. Brian Gill, it's always great to catch up with you, and best wishes to you and cast and crew for Meteor Shower.
Thank you, Greg.
And the time is 8:59 here on WGTD. Tomorrow on the morning show, a change from our published schedule. From the archives, you'll hear my conversation with Stephen Volk, author of Fringeology, a really intriguing look at the paranormal, and more specifically, how we tend to talk about and think about so-called paranormal activity and events. A very, very thoughtfully written book. And then on Friday, we'll be talking about the life and career of one of the NFL